I'm going to call the labor meeting to order. Good afternoon, everyone. Can I get an approve? I'm sure, has anybody had a chance to look over the minutes? And can I get a motion to approve the minutes from March 4th, 2020?
So moved.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes for 2020. For March 4th, 2020. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Well, minutes are approved. First on the agenda today is Representative Sundin with House File 2986. Mr. Chair, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. I will move 2986 be re-referred to the General Register. I have with me today Phil Qualley with UTU Smart Transportation Division to lead off, but first few comments. The railroad workers in Minnesota contacted me last year regarding questions and concerns they had with MnDOT's Freight Rail Office Inspections Program. I encourage them to work with the department to gain consensus and draft legislation to improve state rail safety inspections. The more I have heard about working conditions on railroad lines and yards in Minnesota, it appears this legislation is in fact necessary. I am pleased to present House File 2986, which I understand is consensus language with the department and UTU Smart Transportation Division to assure state rail safety statutes are enforced. This legislation will improve rail inspection and railroad industry safety. Both parties are committed to working together for railroad safety. I ask for your support for House File 2986, and I'll turn this over to Mr. Phil Qualley.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Qualley. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair Cagle, good afternoon, committee members. Thank you. My name is Philip Qualley. I am a state legislative director for the Smart Transportation Division, Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation, formerly the United Transportation Union. I am a railroad conductor of 40 years, yard master, remote control locomotive operator. I'm also a member of the Switching Operation Fatality Analysis Team with the Federal Railroad Administration, a 12-person group that is consisting of the American Association of Railroads, the Short Lines, FRA, the NTSB, and labor unions to assure that railroad workers do not get killed. I will just be very brief with House File 2986. We'd like to thank you for hearing House File 2986 inspection program requirements. The railroad workers have a great deal of respect and appreciation for the efforts of the Minnesota Department of Transportation Railroad Inspection Office. We believe policy language set forth in House File 2986 enjoys consensus language between rail labor and the department. We are proud to have worked to facilitate Minnesota's participation in the Federal Railroad Administration's State Partnership Program during the 2000 and 2007 and 2008 biennium. House File 2986, passage of this bill, will assure state statutes at Chapter 219 and other applicable statutes have full compliance. Passage into law of House File 2986 is necessary. Thank you very much on behalf of our 1,200 members in Minnesota. We'd appreciate your support.
Thank you. Next up on the list, we have David Brown. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brown. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Well, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Dave Brown, and I am the Region National 3 and Minnesota State Legislative Chairman of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, the founding member of the Division of International Brotherhood of Teamsters Rail Conference. For 157 years, the BLT has continued to work with industry, the government, federal agencies, and other rail unions to make certain that railroads provide for the safety of our members, the public, and the environment. I want to express my appreciation for the opportunity to provide this committee with our position for much-needed improvements to the state rail inspection program and commissioner's requirements. We agree and support this legislation's guidance for the commissioner's ability to efficiently, effectively process and enforce non-compliant railroad safety issues and supports the state rail inspectors in their duties of inspecting and reporting railroad safety requirements along with the training and tools necessary to successfully conduct their mission of rail safety. We feel House File 2986 provides transparency when the results of the reported defect are made available to the reporting party and union safety representatives. We feel this bill gives valuable protections for the businesses and citizens that rely on rail transportation to get their products to market in a safe and efficient manner through the state rail inspector's expertise of inspecting railroads for defects and the commissioner's processing enforcements of any noncompliant issues. We support and fully agree with the previous testimony of the Sheet Metal Air and Rail Transportation Union on House File 2986. I ask your support of the House File 2986, providing the commissioners and the state rail safety inspectors the necessary knowledge, instruments, and tools to accurately and investigate and evaluate and report noncompliant safety issues on our state's railroads. We encourage you to vote yes for the safety legislation. I wish to thank Representative Sundin for bringing this important rail safety issue forward. And I want to thank the members of this committee for the opportunity to have my testimony heard here today.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions then. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last year, just outside my district, on the other side of the river, there was a train derailment. And it included empty cars, thankfully. But there was also a two-man crew, and both of those folks were injured. And it was a washout. So I could only imagine, you know, back in the 1900s, late 1800s, washouts were something that happened quite frequently. But I can only imagine in this 21st century that we would be able to prevent people from being injured as a result of a rail washout. But here we are in 2019, well, we're in 20 now, but back in 2019, by gosh, there was a rail washout that caused a crash. Thankfully, nobody was killed, but the engine, I saw the aftermath of the engine. It was on fire, and it was destroyed. Diesel fuel was leaking into the environment. It was not good. It was not a good situation. And so thank you for bringing forth this legislation. I'm going to sign on as a co-author to this bill, and I hope that we can get this to the governor's desk this year. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Sundin, for bringing this forward. I strongly support this as well. And I've had a real interest in this issue in general since the disaster in Canada in 2012 that took 47 lives. My question would be maybe to either of the testifiers. Over the last couple of years, I've tried to bring to the body's attention the fact that Minnesota has more rail miles per capita than many states, but we have less inspectors than states that have fewer rail mileage. And I'm wondering if you feel that at least the number, I know that we're dealing with the training of the inspectors here, but are you satisfied with the number of inspectors that we have in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Brown.
Chair and Representative Hornstein. I believe that we certainly do need more rail inspectors to be on the job, being that there is a large amount of product that's moved through the state, border to border, coming in and going out, that with the type of equipment that we have, some of the equipment is an 18th century technology, some of it's 19th century technology, and it's metal on metal. And we have issues that only the expertise that the rail inspectors that we have and the FRA together, when the FRA is very slim on their personnel, that we need to step up and help and to have people in place to assist them and assist the citizens of the state for a safe rail network.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. If I'm working in the yard, you know, I have ex-students of mine that do work in the yard. If I'm working in the yard, how is this bill going to affect me in terms of safety?
Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. First of all, Representative, we're proud to have your constituent as a member of our union, The way things work on the railroad is our task, of course, is safe behaviors every day and to work safely and report defects to the carrier. Unfortunately, when we report defects to the carriers, oftentimes we don't see them getting repaired. They could be walkway issues. They could be lighting issues. They could be other safety issues. But the men and women who operate the railroads and we're under contract really want to improve our railroad. At that point, once the railroad is notified of a defect or of a safety issue, our local legislative representatives or safety representatives for no contractual authority will contact the carrier and say, hey, is this getting fixed? And when that doesn't quite work and they do not get a satisfactory response and the defect or the unsafe condition is not repaired, they elevate it to the state committee office. We get involved and encourage remediation of the safety problems. Unfortunately, then, what has occurred is the railroads simply don't want to repair the safety defect. They will concentrate on behaviors. Of course, that's like telling the Pope how to be Catholic. You know, of course we want to work safely, but we need a safe physical plant. Our office will write a complaint then to answer your question, Representative, to MnDOT's rail office and ask them to investigate and ask them to, you know, take care of the issue with the carrier and enforce the statutes that generally at Minnesota State Statutes Chapter 219. That's what we strive to do, and what this bill, how this bill will improve safety then is to assure that state rail safety inspectors actually enforce the state statutes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, okay, just kind of maybe give us a little follow. I have a follow-up question here. What's the timeline to get something fixed? If I'm working on the yard and I see a real issue here, currently, what's the timeline to get something fixed? Or maybe it doesn't get fixed.
We expect I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Committee members, I'm sorry. Representative, we want the defects fixed immediately. It's a safety hazard. Unfortunately, in the matter of UTU versus the BNSF, the first notice to the carrier was filed in 2015, and after going through the administrative law process, the matter was settled in 2018, October, with BNSF stipulating agreement, acceding to comply with all the state statutes. So in other words, we had unsafe conditions in a BNSF yard for 3.5 years. Actually, more than 4 years, because the stipulated agreement gave them time to bring in the resources to correct the unsafe conditions.
Okay. And maybe, Madam Chair, just a quick question here. I'm looking through the bill. Is there any additional cost to implement this piece of legislation?
Madam Chair, committee members, we do not believe so. A fiscal note had been issued, if I'm not mistaken, for $38,000 from the department prior to the transportation hearing, although in the last hearing, the director of the rail office, the Freight and Commercial Waterways, I believe Mr. Gardner testified that there would not be a cost and that they could assume that any additional cost. And again, essentially what we're trying to do with this policy language is simply assure that they are trained and enforce and have the equipment to enforce state statutes. So to answer your question, no, not that we are aware of.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions from the members? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the testifiers, and I don't remember your names, I apologize, okay? But you stated in your testimony that we are dealing with 18th and 19th century technology. Can you give me an example of that? Because I'm interested to know.
Mr. Brown?
Madam Chair, Representative, committee members, I've been a railroad employee for 49 years. I've held every position that you can in the operating craft. That means as far as a switch tender all the way up yardmaster, and now I hold as a locomotive engineer for the last quite a few years. After 49 years, you kind of forget how many positions. But anyways, to answer your question, there is a dark territory that has been in effect since the beginning of railroading, where there is no signals. That's why they call it dark territory. The 19th century is the type of pin lifters and type of knuckles and the apparatuses of the rail cars themselves some is antiquated, some is the best that the technology is available, but that's what I was meant by 18th century and 19th century technology.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. So, well, first of all, I think you mean the 1800s and 1900s.
Yes.
Because the 18th century is the 1700s. But that being said, So what's, if that's still there, what's wrong with that? I mean, you're making it sound like the railroads don't want to keep their trains on the track and keeping it running. What's wrong with that technology? What's not working?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, committee members. What's wrong with that is that, that because of its the older equipment and that the type of equipment, the steel on steel, is a factor that you have to consider for the high incidence of maintenance, failures with the equipment, failures with the trackage, the right-of-ways. That all has to be kept a good eye and watched on. It's a continuous process.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is our technology different than, say, Canada's technology when it comes to these things?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, committee members, Representative, Canada, actually, we have what we call the Federal Railroad Administration. They have Rail Canada. Rail Canada actually is more stringent than in a lot of procedures and inspections than the Federal Railroad Administration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Hornstein mentioned the train accident that he was referring to. They have more stringent rules and regulations, I believe you're saying, in Canada. Recently, there was a train derailment carrying oil cars. By the way, if we had line 3 in the ground and replaced, that would be that would help us out a lot, but that's a whole other issue. If that's the case, then there shouldn't be any train derailments in Canada. I'm not exactly sure what we're going for here. If we're, I mean, what you're putting in place here, is that going to be stronger than Canada's requirements, less than, or the same?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, committee members, I can't speak on behalf of that at this time, on whether it would be more stringent. I do believe that having the expertise, the training, and the tools to properly do the job is paramount in the safety of the railroads themselves and for the workers that work with this equipment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the train derailment that I'm familiar with most recently is just across the border from Baudette, Minnesota, over towards Emo, and there was 25 or 30 cars that derailed there. So I'm not exactly sure of why we need this, but I'm continuing to listen. To the other testifier, you said that railroads don't want to fix defects. I wrote that down when you said it. Give me an example. You said there was one that was unsafe condition for 3.5 years. What was that?
Mr.
Yes, I'll answer both of your questions if I may. The scope of this bill, Madam Chair and Representative and committee members, the scope of this bill is to state statutes. State statutes at Chapter 219 and having nothing to do with Canada or some of the mainline federal regulation and federal regulated caused derailments. To your question, this matter was the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway placing non-compliant yard ballast in a railroad yard under State Statute 219-501. And it took that long. You're going to the heart of a problem in our industry, and that's why we need this bill, is to have state inspectors enforce state statutes. We see a delay and physical plant defects, particularly in yards, just don't get repaired. The carriers are short staff maintenance of way workers. We have seen where they're cutting back on the rail, the angle bars, the equipment necessary to maintain the track, as well as the ballast. For example, on the Union Pacific Railway, we have pages and pages of an electronic, which we can present to you if you wish, Madam Chair and committee members, of what they call a safety hotline, where workers have reported safety issues. They receive an administrative response, but the actual physical plant issues don't get repaired. I can't speak for the carriers, but what we see is cutbacks and cutbacks and cutbacks. So under the Railway Labor Act, workers have the right to represent our safety exclusive and independent of any other entity. and we want to go home safely with all of our limbs. Therefore, we seek assistance from the state to enforce state statutes.
One more, Representative Finkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know much about railroads. I'd like to say I know as much about railroads as hogs do about Sunday school, but what is yard ballast? I don't know what that is.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And yard ballast is, first of all, we're thrilled to have Thief River Falls as a on-duty point in your district, and great men and women in far northwestern Minnesota that operate the CP Railway and the CN Railway. Yard ballast is 3/4-inch ballast, and it holds track structure in yards. It is capable. I've brought a couple of sieves to demonstrate the state statute. One is a 1 1/4-inch sieve, and the other is a 1-inch sieve. And the way the statute was constructed was that when you have yard ballast, that you should be able to take a shovel and drop the ballast through the sieve, and 90% of the ballast should be able to drop through the first sieve. 100% of the ballast must be able to drop through the second sieve. The importance of the opposite ballast is called a road ballast, which is 3 to 4-inch rock. And previous legislatures heard the testimony and can demonstrate that there's a real good reason that you don't put road ballast in yards, because it caused cumulative trauma injuries to workers. So yard ballast, as long as it holds a drainage structure, is the prescribed ballast, and it's also consistent with the American Railway Engineering Manufacturing standards. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to respond to Representative Fabian's question, my understanding is that following that disaster in Lac Mégantic in 2012, it was July of 2012, that the Canadian government did strengthen their rail safety protocols, and particularly on liability. I think that was one I know for sure is different than the United States. But I'd be happy to research that a little, Representative Fabian. But my understanding is that they took some pretty drastic and immediate action. They lost 47 souls that day, and so it was a pretty big issue in Canada.
So we'll move to the last question for Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to the implications of the bill itself, looking at lines 1 through 8 and 1 through 9, I guess I'm led to believe that the inspections are not being done now.
Mr. Colley.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think it would be much more appropriate for the department to comment on that. It would be our preference that they do so. Although, to Chair Hornstein's question prior, we are aware that there are great constraints on the inspectors' schedules. For example, we know that the Federal Railroad Administration has lost one of their federal hazardous material inspectors, and so, therefore, there's more workload on the state's hazardous material inspector. But again, this bill is designed to assure that our state statutes are complied with.
Madam Chair.
Representative Vogel.
So it sounds to me that there probably isn't adequate staff right now to do this from what you just said. Where are the people going to come from to do this?
Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm not sure that was my testimony. I think that they can do fine work with who they have now. Yes, they are constrained, but what the intent of the bill is not to increase the number of inspectors. Rather, the inspectors that are here now do inspect and enforce state statutes and are supplied with the proper materials or measurement instruments, as well as be trained in state statutes.
Madam Chair, I know you want to move on, but maybe there's somebody from the department that could answer what's going on. Because I'm confused, because I'm hearing the inspections aren't being done, so therefore we need a statute to say they need to be enforced. And I'm wondering why they're not being done now if there's adequate staff to do it.
Looks like Ms. Witt's making her way up. Sure. And then we do have a number of other bills on the agenda, too, so we could... Hopefully, I have you on the list. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Afternoon, committee. My name is Jennifer Witt, and I'm with MnDOT. So we are doing inspections. We have four inspectors, I believe. Let's see, I looked it up on my phone. There are four inspectors. They have specialties within the inspection area. So some of them are for hazardous materials. Some of them inspect trackage. Motive power is another one. And so we have four across the state. So that does keep us pretty constrained. We have over 4,500 miles of track that we look at. And there are four quadrants that these people operate in. Does that answer your question?
Representative Vogel?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it partially answers it because as I read this, it says that the job isn't being done. You're going to be mandated to do it. But what I'm also hearing is that the people that you have, which are four, are probably maybe inadequate to do this because they don't have you don't have the time or the resource. And that's really who's going to do this. If we enact this statute, it sounds like we're not doing something. We need to do it, and therefore the responsibility is going to be passed to you to do it. So the question is, can you do it with the four people you have, or are you going to take more resources to comply with this new statute?
Ms. Witt, Chair, Representative Vogel, we are complying with this. We do the best that we can with the people that we have. There is a fiscal note, and the cost is zero. Part of this has to do with, as Mr. Qualley explained, the tools. You know, we need to provide those and make sure that those are with all of our inspectors. And so we have brought that up to compliance. And we do feel, we worked on this bill together, and we do feel that we are either in process with all of these, especially the complaint process. We are working that out together in a group. And the rest of it we feel that we are doing. I mean, it's in state statute already. We're not changing the statute about what we have to do. We are just, he's just saying that we have to do it. So the department is okay with this. Does that help?
Thank you, Madam Chair, but, you know, excuse my skepticism. When it says that something isn't being, we need a statute to say something needs to be done because it's already in statute that it's supposed to be done, but now we're going to add the statute saying that it needs to be done, which it should be done anyway. And I'm hearing that there's already sufficient resources, so either the department isn't doing their job with the resources they have or it's going to take more resources. So that's why I'm questioning this. I also then go down to 115 to 117, and it says that the safety inspection program must supply state inspectors with measurement tools required to properly inspect. Mm-hmm. Do we already have those and not using them, or are you going to have to acquire more tools?
Ms. Witt?
Chair, Representative Vogel, we did come up, it was the ballast sieves that we didn't have for a particular inspector, so we have gotten more sieves, so we have those now. And although, I mean, we would be happy to get more staff because there is a lot of trackage across the state. At this point, we feel like this is us being told that they want us to truly make this a priority, and we have. And as for the complaint process, we are working on that with them to come up with something that works all of that out that we can all be happy with, or at least okay with.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I had one. I'm sorry.
One
more, I guess.
Yeah.
Before we leave this, I'm hearing that there's no fiscal note because there's absorbed cost. And yet I'm not hearing an assurance that there isn't going to be any additional cost. And I really think that if we're going to move forward this thing, there should be a fiscal note that really details us out, because I believe, and I think everybody else here does as well, that if there's a need for this legislation, then there's a need for some additional resources of some type. And without a fiscal note that's exploring what they are, I think there's a bill being passed here that isn't going to have proper vetting because we don't know what the costs are. Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, I believe that this bill should be going to Ways and Means. But that being said, I'm a father, coach, and teacher, and I oftentimes heard, Dad, Mark said, or whatever, and I would call, after Eric told me that, and I'd call Mark and say, what happened? What I'm hearing here is, no disrespect meant, I'm hearing one side of the story. So I would, Madam Chair, like to hear from the railroads about these issues to find out what, quote, their side of the story is.
Is there anybody? Well, we called to see if anybody else wanted to testify, and we didn't see anybody come down.
Can't hear you.
Chair Sundin, do you have any comment on that?
No, no, I don't. I don't have any one from the railroad that's ready to present, to my knowledge.
One more?
One last thing. The delays that we're talking about, and I appreciate the concerns, but I think that there are, from Ms. Witt's testimony, it sounds like we may be understaffed, and it takes a while, even when you get a concern, a complaint, whatever it is, or your inspectors are just out doing their stuff. I can't help but think that a part of the delay, once something is filed or received, isn't the result of a lack of resources for the railroad inspectors. Am I wrong?
Ms. Witt?
Chair, Representative Fabian, I would say no. I would say that we work in a very collaborative environment. I mean, MnDOT does not employ police. You know, it's not as though we're going out and doing any of that kind of thing. We work in a collaborative environment. When we get a complaint, part of what we do is we talk with whatever railroad and whatever people are involved within it and try to make some kind of solution that way.
So, Madam Chair, just last one.
Sure.
So just to be clear, that collaborative environment involves, I'll say, the union, the workers, yes, you, and the railroads, correct?
That's it.
Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
That's what I would say.
So we do have room 200 after committee, approximately 6 o'clock if we need it.
This will be a quick one.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Dentmer?
Just a quick question. Are the requirements in this bill, do they also match up with the federal requirements? Are they the same or are they different?
Mr. Pauly?
Madam Chair, committee members, no. Federal regulations are at 49 CFR 200 to 299. Those are separate federal regulations. State inspection or state statutes are separate and apart. They cannot be redundant to the federal, otherwise they would be federally preempted. So we're, to answer your question, no.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. No other questions. I'd like to move to a vote. So, Representative Sundin.
I will renew my motion that House File 2986 be re-referred to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, Representative Sundin, you have another bill, 2987. Would you like to make your motion?
Okay, I'll make a motion that House File 2987 be re-referred to the General Register as well.
All right. Would you like to present your bill?
Okay. Once again, I've been contacted regarding the longstanding need to protect rail worker safety in railroad yards. Railroad workers do not receive live or actual railroad yard evacuation drills from their employers. I have heard from many of my own constituents in Cloquet and Duluth area who confirm this fact, and there have been several very serious injuries and hazardous material exposure injuries in Minnesota's yards. The more I've heard about working conditions on the railroad lines and yards in Minnesota, it appears this legislation is necessary. I'm pleased to present House File 2987, which mandates live evacuation drills for rail workers in yards. I ask for your support for House File 2987, Railroad Yard Evacuation Drills, Worker Safety Training. With me, I have Phil Qualley again, State Director, my friend, and Constituent Assistant Director Nick Kadich from Carlton, Minnesota, from UTU Smart TD, Minnesota, and several conductors and members from the yards with brief comments about the bill. Thank you.
So it looks like we have a number of testifiers on this one, so we are going to be limiting testimony. If we could keep it about 2 minutes, under 2 minutes, we'd appreciate it. So, Mr. Qualley.
Madam Chair, committee members, I will be brief as I possibly can. House File 2987 sets forth requirements on Class 1 and Class 2 railroad carriers in Minnesota to provide live or actual railroad yard evacuation drills. This legislation has been crafted with best practice principles and will have minimal impact on productivity. The practical application as set forth in legislation is efficient, reasonable, and will improve railroad yard emergency response. This safety legislation is not federally preempted. Very quickly, we just wanted to set forth, walk through the bill very quickly. What we're asking for is for all of you to understand. Our railroad workers in Minnesota do not receive live railroad yard evacuation drills. We have had some terrible inhalation hazard exposures and injuries. This bill is necessary, and some other testifiers from the UP, Union Pacific Railway, and Canadian National will testify. However, in the last hearing, we heard testimony from Canadian Pacific and BNSF railroad workers that we do not get live railroad yard evacuation drills. Very quickly, any hazmat testing that railroad workers receive is in our Federal Code of Operating Rules every three-year test, and is only 12 questions on train placement of hazmat materials. Another piece we heard from the carriers was that there's all sorts of plans. Well, why not have the workers involved in the plans? We think this legislation is necessary, it is efficient, and will not pose no undue burden on the carriers whatsoever. I'm joined today by one of our conductors. Madam Chair, I will cease my comments at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Olson, Kurt Olson?
Yes.
All right. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kurt Olson. I'm good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Anyway, my name is Kurt Olson. I'm the local safety and legislative representative of Smart TD Local 650 for about 200 members on the Union Pacific Railway between St. Paul, Roseport Valley Park, Mankato Yard. I have 13 years of service as a conductor and an engineer. For RUP train and yard crews, I ask that you support this legislation, rail yard evacuation drills to protect the lives of our crews. It's long overdue here in Minnesota. In my 13 years, I have never experienced an actual yard evacuation drill, nothing that included crews getting notice on a need to evacuate, wind direction, securing our equipment, and getting off equipment to go to a rally point or any training of that nature. In your committee handout, you will find a letter from our union regarding hazmat exposures from the summer of 2016. I have spoken with our worker, who is a member. There was chaos that night, utter and total chaos. No one knew what to do when the tank car of hydrochloric acid became unstable and began to vent. A vapor cloud shot into the air 150 feet with a plume. The crew went to the yard office complaining of breathing issues and burning eyes. After a while, near the end of their shift, when the hazmat crew was still trying to seal the top of the tank car, UP managers made the crew go out, stand near the car without protection or regard for their safety. They were told by the UP managers that were far downwind to get back on the yard lead and wait for further instructions. The pictures you see was taken by the crew waiting. You should also know there are no safety committees on the Union Pacific. We have a safety hotline, but they do nothing to repair anything reported. There have been a number of reports regarding hazmat issues, but nothing ever actually gets improved or fixed. Our rail workers need this protection and legislative interventions. We need the law to make sure these drills happen, workers get trained on what to do, and safety, and so safety is a done deal. Committee members, for our 200 train crew members, the Local 650, thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Next up, we have Nick Kadich. Did I get that right? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Nick Kadich. I'm a 19-year railroad conductor. I'm here today as the legislative representative for UTU Smart Transportation Division, Local 1067, representing 185 railroad conductors working on the CN in northern Minnesota. CN has two major operations in the northern part of the state, their international corridor beginning in Rainier, and the Iron Range operations supporting several major mines. at CN rail yard locations, including Rainier, Virginia, Keenan, Two Harbors, and Proctor, UTU Smart Transportation Division has asked for and attempted to work with CN to establish emergency response drills that include all of the employees of the railroad. This has not happened, and we currently do not get yard evacuation drills. In 2015, CN abolished our safety committee, and with it, the reporting and tracking of concerns. There is not a safety committee meeting on the CN. When issues were presented to OSHA in 2015 and 2018, they found violations within their jurisdiction, such as old fire extinguishers and a lack of building evacuation plans. But OSHA confirmed that railroad yards and the evacuations of them are outside of their scope and reach. This issue was underscored in Proctor Yard when a discharged cloud of non-odorized propane enveloped a worker, causing permanent and career-ending damage. There was no communication with the workers involved, while other workers in the area continued their tasks without any knowledge of the impending danger. Having live training drills for the safe evacuation of rail yards, which commonly hold many hazardous materials in bulk quantities, is essential for the workers and also for the communities that are immediately surrounding these rail yards. CN has not and will not give us life safety drills, and we ask you to pass this legislation into the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is David Brown, and after him is Joel Mueller. Welcome back. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Brown, and I am the National Region 3 and Minnesota State Legislative Chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. I have nearly 49 years working various operating positions on the BNSF Railroad. I know firsthand the benefits of repeat live situation evacuation training drills after personally assisting as a safety representative for all locomotive engineers that travel in and out of Minnesota with the planning, executing, debriefing, and critiquing of live emergency evacuation drills as a training tool that all first responders must attest to as the safe and positive course of action. In 2002, I was working with local BNSF management to have evacuation signage and windsocks deployed throughout the Northtown, Midway, and Dayton's Bluff yards, as there was none. This also included joint exercises of rail employees and first responders in hazmat situations. The focus of real-time exercises is crucial. The attempts of myself and the SMART TD safety representative to have emergency evacuation drills for all railroad workers has been met with inaction. These live emergency evacuation drills for rail workers can be conducted on a minimal interruption of rail operations. Repetitive annual and semi-annual drills afford rail workers the confidence and knowledge to make the sometimes split-second decisions necessary for a positive result. Those benefits in the level of multiple live action evacuation drills is a safe course of action and having a chance for a successful outcome. There is no one here that is more at risk during a hazmat incident in a rail yard on a daily basis than the rail worker. We work in and around these large rolling hazmat containers with every dangerous chemical and gas known to exist. The railroads, carriers, and their lawyers do not have the same risk of injury or losing their lives in a hazmat incident in a rail yard that we railroaders face each and every day. Many problem areas and situations can be scrutinized and remedied through the debriefing of all participants after an evacuation drill to determine where the best location to shelter in place or how that is safely achieved, or the best and safest course of evacuating location of a hazmat incident to safely and who was left in a hot zone or near the warm zone, what missteps were made and how we can correct them when working in and around these railroad yards every day without injuries or death. I ask and encourage your support of House File 2987, providing emergency preparedness evacuation safety drills in rail yards, and make it a permanent commitment to the safety of rail workers, first responders, and the general public. I wish to thank especially Representative and Chairman Sundin for bringing this important rail safety issue forward, and I want to thank Madam Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to have my testimony heard here today.
Thank you. Joel Mueller, and then after that, Paula Jossart. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paula Jossart, and I am an attorney locally here, and I represented a gentleman who was affected by the inaction that we have by these rail carriers, specifically the BNSF, at the Northtown Yard right here in Minneapolis. My gentleman was injured. His name is Scott Kovaleski, and he is permanently injured to the point where he can barely walk and barely talk by hazmat and by being presented never with any kind of live drill in that yard. On this particular day, the railroad was humping, and what that means is they were throwing down a hill hazmat cars loaded with hydrocarbons. They called it hydrocarbons. Not a single soul in that yard that was working down there that day knew what a hydrocarbon was. It's dirty oil from the oil fields, and it can kill you, and it can damage your brain, and that's what it did to him that day. They're humping these cars, they're crashing together, and it's releasing this hazardous gas that is invisible, and it took away his brain. He has what's worse than Parkinson's. It's very progressive. He's almost bound in a wheelchair. He's just 50 years old. And what happened that day is no one knew what to do. This gentleman was taken out. They could smell something. No one knew what to do. There was no whistle. There was no alarm. There was nothing. And he went there, and they put him in the back of a van, and they took him up to the yard office, to the cafeteria, for God's sake, and they sat him there. And he laid his head down, and nobody helped him, not a manager. No one knew what to do. And they can come to you with these big policies and these big books of, this is what we do, this is our safety plan. But if no one knows what to do, this man was permanently injured. They didn't help him. And finally, a former police officer, just a coworker, came in and said, my God, we have to call the ambulance. And after 45 minutes of him sitting there in this gas that forever changed his life, they finally got him to an ambulance. Nobody knew what to do. You can have everything in black and white, and you can have all the safety rules in place, but if no one knows what to do, and no one has practiced what to do, and no one has the knowledge of the chemicals, things like this happen to this man. His coworker is dead as a result of this. He blew his head off because the chemicals hurt his brain to the point of PTSD. And so this bill is vitally important, and it affects everything, because if you don't have a plan in your yard and these materials go back out to the communities that are driving through your backyards and maybe affecting the kids that you coach, it's not okay. So I think this bill is very important for all of us to understand and pass for the safety of the railroad workers and for all communities that face these hazardous materials.
Thank you. Joel Mueller? And after that, John Abbotts?
Madam Chair, if I may, while Mr. Mueller comes up, very quickly, our bill simply calls for 2 evacuations per year with actual live drills. Current statute will have the public emergency responders perform a drill with the railroads once a year, and we thank the legislature for that 2014 legislation. However, the railroad workers are not included in that evacuation drill whatsoever. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Mueller. I'm a locomotive engineer working on the Union Pacific Railroad. In my 25 years in that craft, I've worked in many freight classification yards throughout the state of Minnesota. Every one of these yards has had placarded hazardous material freight cars pass through every day. It is imperative that the railway employees that work in these yards have an evacuation plan and know the fastest way out of the yard when there is an emergency involving hazardous material. Railroad employees are often required to work in freight yards that they are not familiar with, and each freight yard has its own characteristics and track layout. These freight yards can be confusing for employees that are not familiar with that particular freight yard and can easily become disorientated. Because the layout of these yards often resembles a maze, it would become easy should an emergency happen for an employee to become trapped in that yard, putting not only that person's life in danger, but also the lives of the emergency responders. It is also imperative that the railroad employees know of the layout of the yard and evacuation routes so they can relay information to emergency responders. On the railroad I work for, there is no evacuation plans in place in any of the freight yards I'm required to work in. With many different crews working at the same time in the same area, it is possible that there could be an emergency and other employees working in that area would not know about it. Without an evacuation plan in place, the railroads operating throughout the state of Minnesota are putting the lives of employees, emergency responders, and general public at risk. Thank you.
Thank you. After John Abbott, then we have Dale Buchholz. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Abbott. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And before we start, I just want to apologize to Representative Fabian. I wasn't paying attention when I should have been on that last bill, and we don't have any particular problems with 2986. So I just wanted to get that on the record. I've been lobbying on behalf of the railroads and several other entities up here for several decades, and I do understand the perils of opposing a chairman's bill in his own committee. It's kind of analogous to driving around the gates when at a grade crossing when the train's coming. I advise you not to do that. But that said, before the legislature imposes new requirements on the railroads for a variety of safety things, it's important, I think, for you to have a context in terms of the training and in terms of what we do to protect employees and maintain safe operations. I want to just say there's four major railroads that operate in Minnesota. There's 17 small railroads that operate here as well, 16 small railroads, depending on how you count them. And even given the fact that it applies to the four railroads, the bill is very, very broad and affects a lot of folks involved here. All railroads are subject to the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA's jurisdiction, and a number of other federal and state agencies as well. The FRA is primarily responsible for enforcing safety regulations on railroads. In Minnesota, we also, under legislative mandate, deal with the Department of Transportation. We work with the MPCA. We work with the Department of Public Safety and others to ensure that there's safe operations and our workers are safe. We also then maintain our own programs of emergency response and coordinate with a host of local responders when doing drills and doing other sorts of exercises. We do plan, we do train, we do exercise in advance of situations should they ever occur. So to give you a better idea of how we do that, let me just suggest, first of all, we're going to have Ed Dankbar, who is the emergency response officer for CP Rail here. We've also got John Gebenheim, who is the environmental officer for CP, and as well are fortunate to have Paul Hester here, who is the hazmat operations manager for field operations, actually on the ground. So, Madam Chair, thank you for letting us present our testimony. We'll be available when we've done so.
Thank you. And after Mr. Buchholz is Paul Hester. So welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm actually Ed Dankbar, CP Hazmat Manager and Emergency Response Officer for U.S. West Operations. Mr. Buchholz was unable to join us today. I'm responsible for emergency planning and preparation for our railroad throughout Minnesota, North Dakota, Western Wisconsin, and Northern Iowa. I'm responsible for responding to and overseeing any emergencies, hazmat emergencies, or environmental emergencies for my territory. With me today, as Mr. Appitz mentioned, I also have John Gibbenhain, Environmental Officer for CP US West, and Hazmat Manager Paul Hester with BNSF. Let me start by saying that safety of our employees, our operations, and the communities we operate in, CP's first priority. And that goes for every other railroad that operates in Minnesota. We do a great deal of planning and training to assure that we are prepared for a variety of possible emergency situations. Allow me to explain some of what we do. By federal law, all railroad employees must receive hazardous materials and security training within 90 days of hire. By federal law, all railway employees must receive hazmat training every 3 years thereafter. Federal Railroad Administration also audits these hazmat training programs every 3 years to make sure that we're compliant and we're actually doing these trainings. Training for qualified personnel in our engineering, operation, and mechanical departments include hazmat training refresher, HAZCOM training, and emergency response modules as assigned. Our engineering departments also go through annual hazmat training as applicable to job tasks. Railroad personnel at all levels are expected to be involved in safety planning and preparedness. In Minnesota, CP has four health and safety committees that include representatives from all CP terminals within the state. These committees meet monthly, and they conduct safety audits within our terminals and within our customer sightings, so the tracks that our customers have. CP updates its corporate emergency response plans annually and also reviews its terminal emergency action plans annually. You have copies of the system-wide integrated contingency plan for our local emergency action plan guides on the packets that you grabbed when you walked in. Railroads must comply with Federal Community Right to Know Act, which requires our industry report the storage, use, and release of any hazardous substance to federal, state, and local governments. We also report directly to the state of Minnesota. Our plans identify critical infrastructure and rally points for emergency responders and railway employees. All railroads work with local fire departments to identify entry and rally points and have systems for assuring accountability. Madam Chair, I know this is a long laundry list of what we do to keep our railroads operating safely, but as you are considering this bill, I believe it's important that you also understand what we already do before adding new mandates. With that, I think John Giebenhain has a few comments.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives, my name is John Giebenhain. I'm an environmental officer for CP. I've been with CP for almost 10 years. I'll be brief. I just have a couple of points here. My first point about House Bill 2987 is regarding specifically Section 1.15 through 1.18, and I'm going to read that. The bill says for this specific legislation and where these evacuation drills are going to be required. It says that the rail carrier moves one or more rail cars containing hazardous materials, spots rail cars to an industry, blocks rail cars for departure, sets rail cars out from a train, or switches or inspected rail cars, and more than 400 rail cars are moved through each calendar week. And to provide some comment regarding that, just wanted to let everybody know that one unit train of hazmat is about 100 cars. And CP ships numerous unit trains of these daily. So that means, per this definition, that just within one day, we're going to meet this definition at over 240 terminals across CP, which includes about 1,100 miles. Of those 240 terminals, you have to do a drill at these twice a year. So we're talking almost 500 drills per year. Of these 240 terminals, six terminals would be comparable in size to the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Can you imagine shutting down the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and the impact it would have on both the local and national level if you had to do an evacuation drill? Also, there's nothing in this definition that specifically discusses personnel. It all just has to do with hazmat shipments, nothing to do with how many employees are at a terminal per day. So that's one issue I have. The second issue I have is that this proposed legislation is as an amendment to Minnesota 115E finish, Minnesota 115E bill. Which is an environmental bill enforced by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I was wondering if the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is aware that they're going to be required to enforce this bill should it go to legislation. I would foresee that this would have a great undertaking for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to oversee the evacuation drills on the CP alone, not to mention the other three Class 1 railroads and the short lines, of over 500 drills annually. Thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Paul Hester with the BNSF Railroad.
It looks like he's the last testifier on the list.
Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Paul Hester. I'm the Hazardous Materials Field Manager and Emergency Operations Manager for the BNSF Railway in this territory. And I just wanted to stress that John and Ed spoke about Canadian Pacific's programs, and I'll speak a little bit about the BNSF programs. So the definition of the terminal is an issue with this bill, and I wanted to make sure and reiterate that BNSF already does drills and exercises at the major rail yards in Minnesota. It's called our local emergency response plan, and while plans are only as good as the action in these plans is specific guidelines on how to do exercises. Part of those exercises is an evacuation and an all-call internal action plan, basically, for folks to be able to evacuate, whether it's to go to a fixed evacuation point or to an evacuation point that fits the hazard that has been presented in the incident. Also, the safety committees that are present at BNSF have representation by all crafts, which includes union employees. So those safety committees on the BNSF administer these local emergency response plans and the exercises that those require. This makes our safety paramount, and it makes it a bottom-up action as far as if they identify shortcomings in our evacuation plans, then they can be fixed as part of the after-action review. That's all I have.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing nobody coming, Representative Detmer, and I just want to make a plea.
Okay.
My grandma's in town visiting. If I don't get home tonight, I'll be
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, to the testifier, is this the plan? Is this the action plan for what we're talking about today?
That was the Canadian Pacific's, Madam Chair, Representative. That's Canadian Pacific Railway's system-wide emergency response plan. BNSF has one that's very similar. There are also additional plans called local emergency response plans or yard response plans that would require individual evacuation drills.
Okay.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, and then on lines 119 and 120, the carrier must include employees in the evacuation planning, live drills, and post-evacuation reviews and debriefings for the drills. I like that wording because we always do that in military. You have an after-action report after you go through the drills. Are the employees also involved in deciding what kind of drills you're going to have because they're on the job?
Mr. Hester or Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to respond. No. And, in fact, if I may respond to several of the carrier's statements that have been made here that I'm unfortunately, if not misleading, incorrect. No, we're not. And, again, if you have all these plans in place, then why aren't the workers getting evacuation drills? We are not getting drills. Mm-hmm. How many people like sports? How many people like the arts? Teams practice. That doesn't happen in the railroad industry, and we need these drills. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question for Chair Sundin. Sometimes when these bills come forward, and this has been around, I believe, since last year. Yeah. No, it's just this spring, I'm sorry, early winter. What conversations have you had personally with the railroads and with regards to maybe amending your bill or something like that? Are you open to that to try to work through something that is more amenable to both parties?
Chair Sundin.
I've had plenty of input from Mr. Qualley and company and had conversations with the railroads in my office as well, and they've all been pleasant, and I'm receptive to any amendments we can have a look at if they've got some suggestions. But this is a issue that's near and dear to me. To back up Representative Detmer's comments about drilling, you know, the military does it. I've been in industrial settings where the drilling that we did for safety evacuations really paid off. I was 200 feet into a confined tunnel, and when we lost power and we could have been overcome with the toxic materials that we're applying inside that tunnel. The drilling that we did ensured that everyone was evacuated from that building, about 200 workers, construction workers, and we were the last ones out. And we were counted, everybody was accounted for. The drill works. So I'm a believer and will continue to be.
So,
Representative Fabian.
Madam Chair, what's the motion on this bill again?
The motion was to General Register.
Okay. So I would like to amend the motion with the Chair's permission. I serve on the Environment Committee, and 115E.042 is the environmental protection stuff. I think that this should go to the Environment Policy Committee so that we can get some testimony from MPCA. Would you be amenable to that, Mr. Chair?
I don't know. Excuse me, Madam Chair, but I don't know if the MPCA is actually involved in crafting this. So I would I'd recommend you don't amend the motion.
May I add?
Mr. Qualley?
Madam Chair, also in the statute, and to your question on history, the railroad workers are referenced in attending MPCA annual response drills. So I think this has already been contemplated and were referenced in the MPCA drills. This has to do with railroad safety. This has to do with worker safety explicitly. We've simply crafted putting it into this section because the fire response, public responders, is already in this section. Thank you.
Last follow-up, Representative Fabian.
I respect that, but you're amending 115E.04 or 0.042, which is environmental protection, and that should come to the Environment Policy Committee. I mean, we went through some of these things last year, and then we had to re-refer and do that on the House floor and all that stuff. I just think it would be cleaner if it went through the proper channels, but the majority can do.
I defer to the chair, and he's giving me the note.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll consult with the MPCA and the chairs of the appropriate committees. We can get back to this, and I can ask for a re-referral on the floor if it's necessary.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not ask. I was originally going to ask a question of one of the witnesses. I'm not going to, just in the interest of time. But my concern, there was a statement about complying with right to know, and my experience has been that there are a number of exemptions related to railroads when it comes to the community right to know. And so I just wanted to, you know, put that out there, and we can have a discussion another time. But it's been very difficult to get information about hazardous materials from the rail industry and in communities and in workplaces. So I just have that concern, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sundin, Chair Sundin, for bringing this bill. I live where the most active rail crossing is in the United States. 30 to 33 trains go across the bridge at Rainier every day. And Representative Fabian mentioned oil cars in the previous bill. Oil is probably maybe one of the least hazardous chemicals that are being transported across there. We don't know what some of those chemicals are being transported across there. And you know why they are, Madam Chair? Chair Sundin? Because they're transported through there because it's one of the least populated areas in the country, and the railroads would have less duties to clean up because of the people who are there. The railroad road near Rainier, if we had a derailment in there, there's better than 200 homes that are completely cut off from evacuation. And if we have prevailing northwest winds, which we have normally up where I live, those 200 homes are in trouble. So thank you for the bill. It's definitely necessary. The plant that I worked in has yearly evacuation drills because of the chemicals hauled by those railroads. The railroads can certainly have evacuation drills too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Eklund. I actually stayed at one of your constituents' houses that overlooked that bridge right there in Rainier, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my reading of the bill and listening to the discussion is that the bill is asking for that when they do these annual whatever simulations with the fire departments and whatever, that the workers be included in them. So they do evacuations drill. I think back to when I was in grade school, which was a couple years ago, and even when my kids were in grade school, they have semi-annual fire evacuations where they don't tell them where they're going to do and they throw the alarm off and they line everybody up so the kids know where to go. I think this is not a whole lot different than that, is to make sure that the people know that are working on these places, other than just sitting there at a table saying this is where you go, actually do it so they know where to go. The other thing is that I'm looking at this, and this is a great, looks like a great plan, and I think all the railroads have these plans, but as we found out on our presidential primary day, the Secretary of State has an emergency plan similar to this, to what happens, what you're supposed to do when something goes wrong. Well, we had a little IRP with the Pole Finder website, and somebody, even though they didn't go to this and didn't follow it because maybe they hadn't practiced it, and I don't know about that for a fact, but they went to this, and we had a lot of people screaming at the Secretary of State office because they actually clicked on the wrong thing and had people directed to a site that they shouldn't have gone to. It's important that if they're going to have a safety plan, that the workers walk through it. Walking through it adds to the safety of the workers and everybody involved.
Thank you. Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, okay, I'm not necessarily opposed to workers walking through things and so forth, but what I'm interested in is the process that we have here in the legislature, and I really believe that this bill needs to go to environment policy.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, then I will let the chair renew his motion.
Just a couple comments. First, Madam Chair, you know, we've heard about plans, we've heard about audits, we've heard about meetings. We've heard about drills, which are far more important. We do it in elementary schools with fire. We do it in industrial settings, in the mills. We do it in construction projects, and it saves lives, and it keeps sends the workers home healthy every day. So I propose that we support House File 2987, and I remove my motion that it be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lilly, looks like you are on deck here. Or no, you're going. You're, it's you. Go ahead. Sorry. Well, not you. Welcome to the committee. I move that House File 3732 be referred to State Government Finance. Representative Lilly, you can go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I found the discussion quite interesting. I just got done with my training with a major airline employer in our state, so it was interesting to hear the discussion. House File 3732 is a bill that ratifies the labor contracts and compensation plans for the state employees that we have working for us. These contracts and plans are for FY 20 and 21 biennium and are retroactive to July 1st. These contracts are negotiated between MMB and the various work groups in the state, and there's changes in many areas that are meeting some of the challenges that we're seeing in employment in the state, whether it be job retention and many of the various things, exactly the same things you see in private industry. But I'll just run through it real quickly, and then I'll pass you to Mr. Hubinger for the real expert. But Subdivision 1 is the ASPE contracts. There's about 15,000 employees. Subdivision 2 is Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, about a 15,000 work group. Subdivision 3 is the radio operators, and there's about 57 of those folks. Middle management is Subdivision 4, and there's about 3,200 employees in that group. Subdivision 5 is going to Minnesota State, and its faculty there, about 780 employees. Subdivision 6 is interfaculty, again, in our higher ed institutions, about 3,000 employees. And yesterday, I don't know if you had any visitors, there was people from this work group, correction officers, and there's about 1,900 that were in this work group, and some were yesterday at the Capitol. Subdivision 8 is some of our schools, various schools like the Deaf and Blind School and the Purpose Center, and there's 181 or so of those employees. Subdivision 9 is college faculty contract. There's about 4,100 full-time employees in our technical and community colleges in that group. And then towards the end here is Subdivision 1. There's Minnesota State Administrators and about 566 employees in that group. And these are vital workers in our team that help implement what we do here as policymakers. And, you know, I'm quite proud of our staff and listen to many of your retirement speeches when you quit or you think when you have bills up before a committee and you thank our staff, and that's who these are. There's people, you know, throughout our whole government that are doing good work, and retention certainly has been a problem. But I'd like to pass to, we're lucky to have Mr. Hubinger. He's helps represent us in the contracts between the House and the Senate and kind of help them become law. And he can tell you more in detail of the bills. Mr. Hubinger, if.
Mr. Hubinger, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. Representative Lilly has indicated which groups the ratification bill applies to. I thought I'd just highlight a couple of the major benefit components for you. The one is the insurance benefits, which is a significant component that's negotiated by a joint House-Senate, joint Labor Management Committee. And as a result of those joint negotiations, the benefits are consistent across the labor contracts. There weren't any major changes in the underlying plan design, but there were substantial changes in the out-of-pocket costs, such as first-dollar deductibles and co-pays and co-insurance. The second major component is salary, and the contract's pattern provides for a 2.25% increase that was effective July 1st, 2019, and then a second 2.5% across the board increase that would be effective next July, or July of this year, July of 2020. The third component of salary or compensation are step increases or performance-based increases. Those are dependent on a performance evaluation of each employee each year. Those increases vary by contract between generally 2.75% and 3.5%. They're only available to employees who are not at the top of their salary ranges, and so only about half of state employees are eligible for these increases. The handout that you have, I think, from the subcommittee has a chart on the back that is a tracking sheet that the subcommittee uses for keeping track of the cost of the contracts. That summary data indicates that the cost of these increases will have an impact of about 4.8% on budgets in this biennium. And when you annualize the cost of the contract increases, will have an impact of about 8.29% on the 22-23 biennium. Mr. Chair, there are staff here from MMB and Minnesota State. If you have detailed questions about the contracts, otherwise I could try to respond.
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I neglected to mention two key things. On the bill is bipartisan authorship, and I think that's always important in this place to kind of get an idea of what we're dealing with. And Representative Neal is on the bill. But there's also, I want to be honest, there's other contracts that are catching up, and Mr. Hubinger can kind of say where they're at. But there's going to be other bills that we're going to merge in. So maybe before Ways and Means, but I don't want to be dishonest or misrepresent it. This will not be the full breadth of the contracts that we'll see this session. So there's going to be, but the other contracts will be quite similar to this. So anyways, I just wanted to be straight up on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. Any questions from the committee? Representative Vogel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering if somebody from MMB is here to maybe answer a few questions.
I understand that's the case. you state your name and proceed or prepare yourself for questions.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. My name is Kristen Batson. I am the Acting Deputy Commissioner of Enterprise Human Capital with Minnesota Management and Budget. And under law, we are charged with negotiating contracts with the majority of bargaining units that represent state employees.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I see in the letter that MMB estimates that the increased cost will be 4.84 in this biennium. I'm curious how you came up with that number.
Please.
Chair Sundin, I'm going to call a colleague of mine, Dory Leland, up, who was part of the costing that went into these negotiations.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dory Leland. I'm an enterprise director with Minnesota Management and Budget.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is, it says MMB estimates that the increased cost in this biennium will be 4.84%, and I'm wondering how you came up with that number.
So when we are, thank you, when we're determining the cost of the contract, we determine the costs based on information that we have, what we refer to as the negotiations database, which has information about all of our state employees, what their current salary is, what the predicted increases are going to be due to steps, and then also based on the negotiated yearly increases.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I asked a question is I went back just on the first one, AFSCME, and it's 2.25 the first year, 2.5 the second year for raises, which comes out to about that 4.84%. But it also mentions that the steps are 2.7%, and about 50% of the people qualify for those. And I'm wondering how that is calculated into the information that we're given.
Ms. Leland, please.
I think you have a...
The chair, just kind of address the chair.
Right. Sorry. All right. Sure. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not sure I have a good answer to your question as I'm sitting here today, but I would be happy to provide you with a detailed response. I need to talk to the people on my team who do this specific costing information to, and also to the budget people at MMB who are not here today to answer that question.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's best then that we wait. My concern is that we really need a good cost estimate here. Because it goes into the budget matters, and I'm not so sure that we're counting everything into it. So maybe it may be best to wait. I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vogel. This will be heard in state government finance, so there's be plenty of opportunity.
Thank you.
Anything further? Any further questions? Any comments from the gallery? Representative Lilly, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, thank you very much for hearing us. We've got a few more stops along the way, and we can answer your questions. I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate your support, and I think it's important to the employees of the state of Minnesota.
At this point, I will move House File 3732 be re-referred to the State Government Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. You're on your way. Thank you. Okay, we have Representative Hewitt with living organ donors, status discrimination prohibited, paid leave benefits extended, and unpaid leave required, and conforming change made. I move House File 1741 be re-referred to Commerce. Mr. Hewitt, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. This is a bill I received by adoption through Representative Zerwas, the former Representative Zerwas. 1741 actually does some great things. It prohibits companies and insurance companies from discriminating against individuals that have willing to donate in this case, a kidney or bone marrow, Basically, what we've been running into trouble with certain institutions and certain insurance companies is that once these people have done this, now they're not eligible for insurance, they're not eligible for certain benefits, and this is really reaching out to your fellow brother or sister to try to help them live a fulfilled life. Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Any questions on the bill carried formally by
the Nick bill Zerwas, was carried formally by Zerwas. The former Representative Zerwas.
Thank you. Any questions to the bill? Any testifiers? Anybody in the gallery that wishes to weigh in?
Got a little worried. There's a former Representative Gottwaltz eyeing me here.
Thank you. Please identify yourself, and let's hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Jenny Anderson. I'm the chair of the Minnesota chapter of the National Kidney Foundation Board of Advisors. I'm also an associate vice president at Holmes Murphy & Associates, an employee benefits consulting firm. Back when I was 14, I wrote a book titled, it was about my life, The Good and Bad Times of Jenny Anderson's Life. In one of the chapters, when I was looking towards the future and for the hopes of my future, I wrote, I want to find my Aunt Judy a brand new kidney and make sure nothing goes wrong. Little did I know that 5 years later, when I was 19, I did find her one, and it was mine. I was 19, I just finished my freshman year of college, and so when I was going through my kidney donation process, I had two main concerns. First, would she reject the kidney, or would the transplant be a success? And also, what I was going to do over summer break, would I be able to go to the beach, and would I be able to go rollerblading after the transplant? Since 2000, I've been an advocate for living donation. We need to look at not just the feel-good stories of increasing the number of living donors and reducing the barriers that they face, but also the financial impact. Some things that you need to know about kidney, chronic kidney disease, is that once somebody goes through permanent kidney failure, there's no way to reverse it. There's two treatment options, dialysis or kidney transplant. Do you know that in 2016, 23% of Medicare spend was spent directly for treating chronic kidney disease? That's $114 billion. So if we can get this living protection in place, we can go and actually reduce the amount of Medicare spent towards treating chronic kidney disease. Now when I'm talking to kidney donors, they talk to me and ask me, what happens to my job? Will I get time off? I don't qualify for FMLA. And also, what about adverse consequences when it comes to health, life insurance, disability insurance, and long-term care? Like I said, if we can eliminate these non-medical barriers, we can increase the living donors, reduce health care, and Medicare spend for everyone. We'd like to ask for your support with House File 1741. Thank you, everyone, for your time today.
Okay, Representative Hewitt.
I have nothing further to add. She did just had a wonderful job, and I thank you. For
any questions to the testifier or the author? Okay, we have one more testifier. Please identify yourself. Proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Adam Dwaron, and I'm on the National Kidney Foundation Minnesota Board of Advisors. I'm also the Director of Services at Werner Electric, an electrical distributor serving most of Minnesota and western Wisconsin. Thank you, Chairman and Committee leadership, for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1741. About 8 years ago, I started working at Rockwell Automation in Roseville, where I became friends with one of my colleagues, Jen. At the time, Jen was living with FSGS, a disease in which scar tissue forms in the kidneys, ultimately leading to kidney failure. Over the next couple of years, the disease advanced to the point of kidney failure and thus began her journey with dialysis. The challenges of dialysis and doctor's visits made it impossible for Jen to continue working a normal job. The couple people who stepped forward to help Jen to become potential donors were not matches for one reason or another. I talked it over with my wife, and we both agreed it would be a great opportunity for me to help someone by trying to donate my kidney. Fortunately for me, I had a company who fully supported Jen's journey and my interest in helping a fellow colleague. I was able to take the time off as needed to donate and recover only a week without the repercussion of losing my job. A lot of people, however, don't have the luxury of unlimited vacation or available time off to do something good for someone else. By breaking down some barriers to donation, more living donors will be able to donate to friends, family members, or even strangers without fear of losing their job or having their insurance premiums increase unfairly. As for my health, I've never been in better shape. My family physician says I'm probably the healthiest patient he has. The same goes for other kidney donors out there. Let's enable others to share the health and lower the overall financial burden to our fellow citizens. We would ask for your support in passing House File 1741. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions to the author or the testifiers? Okay. Hearing none, I move House File 1741 be re-referred to Commerce. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you, committee.
Got a bill. Okay. Is Representative Stevenson available?
He left.
Please. Yeah. Let's see if we can do this in 2 minutes. To the committee, while we search for the author of the next bill, this bill is headed for Subcommittee on Local Government, and there's some work to do on the bill, I understand. And he's not here anyway, so we're going to lay this bill over until, no action on the bill. We'll take it up at the next committee meeting. Thank you. We're adjourned.